Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Iraqi militants displayed 7 kidnapped Turkish citizens today, saying the men had been taken because they were working for American companies inside Iraq. And the militants threatened further attacks on Westerners in the country. Meanwhile, Italian and Polish hostages were freed by American commandos in what is being described as a bloodless operation south of the city of Baghdad. Several insurgents were arrested. Meanwhile, questions have surfaced concerning the most famous coalition-held detainee of them all, Saddam Hussein. Fear and lack of hard evidence are threatening to derail the trial of Hussein, even though coalition forces have been interrogating many of his men. Joining us on the line is Michael Evans, defense editor of the Times of London, which broke this story. And Michael, Saddam Hussein was in power for years. Hundreds of official documents were found after the fall of Baghdad. How could there be lack of evidence?
I think the most important thing with these sort of very, very high-profile trials is that they need to have pretty well star witnesses, if you like, who can give contemporary evidence of Saddam Hussein's personal involvement in some of the atrocities which have been well chronicled. It's always important to get the document with his signature on, or the witness who said, yes, I saw Saddam Hussein do this or do that, or issue this order or that order. It's very important, I think, for the judges in the trial of Saddam Hussein, which will probably take place next year, that they hear evidence that provides the direct link between some atrocity and the former dictator.
Well, you report that there is a witness who claims to have some evidence of Saddam's involvement in the gassing of, 5,000 Kurds in 1988, that this witness heard a communication?
Indeed. I think, you know, when you have to put this into the context of a trial, you know, his defense counsel might be able to say, well, how do you know it was Saddam Hussein? What were the circumstances in which you were listening to this conversation, etc.? And all these things will come into play. That's why I say it would make it much easier for the prosecution if they had a star witness.
There is another element here that you write about, and that is fear. You spoke with Salem Chalabi, nephew of Iraqi governing council member Ahmed Chalabi, who is organizing the trial of Saddam Hussein. Salem is. He spoke about the fear affecting the trial.
Yes, indeed. The fear factor is there to such an extent that they won't even name the judges who are going to take part in the trial for fear that action may be taken against them before they appear.
Some of these witnesses, there's going to be an attempt to protect them, a witness protection program, much like being used in Yugoslavia in the trial of Slobodan Milosevic. But as you write and as we're seeing, that trial isn't going very well.
No, I mean, it's been going on for a long time. They've had more than 100 witnesses, and a huge number of documents, etc., have been put forward in the prosecution case. It's very important that there is a direct link proved between Milosevic and the genocide that took place.
So are you saying there is no, even with so many of Saddam Hussein's men in custody, there is no such star witness yet?
There is no such star witness. There are currently 40 people on the famous pack of cards list of 55 who are in detention. All of them are, you know, high-ranking former regime members, and none of them have come forward with any information either on the possible whereabouts, if they exist, of weapons of mass destruction, or of evidence that they're prepared to give against their former leader. So, no.
Michael, before we let you go, very briefly, where is Saddam Hussein right now? And Salem Chalabi says that he will be handed over to the Iraqis by the U.S. and coalition forces directly after June 30th.
I think that is, to be honest, I think that's most unlikely, partly because the American authorities who are interrogating Saddam Hussein, I'm sure, have not finished their task. But where Saddam Hussein is right now, I don't know. But one thing I do know is that he is in Iraq, and that the Red Cross, for example, have been to see him, and they've been to see him in Iraq. So I imagine he is in detention somewhere either in or on the outskirts of Baghdad.
Michael Evans, thank you.
Thank you.
Michael Evans, defense editor of the Times of London. He spoke to us from London.
The United Nations Security Council is expected to approve a resolution today that defines the powers of the new Iraqi interim government scheduled to take over June 30th. Germany and France dropped their opposition to that handover plan after a revised draft of the resolution was sent to the Security Council yesterday. Joining us on the line is Jérôme Godefroy, deputy news director of RTL Radio Network in France. Welcome, Jérôme.
Hello, how are you?
Very well, thanks. You know, the U.S. and U.K. had to do some work here to get the approval of France and Germany. What specifically did France want from this resolution?
The French want in the first place that the new Iraqi government might have something to say about any big military action by the U.S. forces. But that was not a major obstacle. In the end, the French government wanted to find a good compromise between the U.S., the British, and the French government because this resolution is really needed.
Well, as you say, it was a compromise. The final draft that was sent to the Security Council didn't contain all the things that France wanted.
Yes, that's right. But, you know, it's always the same at the UN. You try to push some ideas. Some ideas are accepted, some are not. This is the game. This is the deal.
Jerome, what about the French people? What has been the reaction there to the government's compromise with the U.S. and U.K. over this resolution? Because France certainly wasn't backing down a year and a half ago.
Well, you know, you don't expect the French people to follow this matter so closely. You know, a UN resolution is really something very, very far from their day-to-day preoccupations. But in the press, finally, we say it's good to have a resolution in spite of the fact that we didn't get everything we wanted to have. And the problem is far beyond this resolution. What we want to achieve is the peace and a long-term solution for Iraq.
You mentioned the press a moment ago. How big or not is this story playing there?
Well, in my radio station, it was not the leading story this morning or tonight. And in Le Monde, for instance, which is published in the evening here in Paris, it's not even the main headline. It's inside. It's a rather short story. It's not the major preoccupation and the major matter these days here.
One event that did get a lot of coverage in France, of course, was the observances in Normandy over the weekend. And do you see that as helping heal this rift between the U.S. and France?
Absolutely, absolutely. And it was very moving when we saw, you know, these old men, veterans from World War II coming back to Normandy. We are so grateful to America for what you did 60 years ago, and this is something we cannot forget. And it was good to remember all these things in spite of the fact that we still have differences on Iraq. Iraq is just one episode. It's a tragic episode, but it has nothing to you know, to alter the profound friendship that there is nevertheless between the U.S. and the French people.
So the French people are not as angry about this as they were a year and a half ago.
No, absolutely not. You know, we are still, you know, you are the big guys. What can we do? we have to live with you, and we like you pretty much.
Well, happy to hear that's continuing. Jerome, thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Jerome Godefroy is Deputy News Director of France's Radio Television L. He spoke to us from Paris.
The story of the Pentagon report seeking to prove legal justification for the use of torture is getting reaction today. The Washington Post reports that a full year earlier, a Justice Department memo first built the legal arguments later used in the Defense Department memo revealed yesterday. That memo makes two clear points: that U.S. interrogators can claim a Nuremberg-type defense, and that the President of the United States answers to no laws if he's defending the country from attack. Well, the Pentagon says today that those memos were just testing out legal theories and didn't have the force of policy. Scott Horton is former head of the New York City Bar Association's Human Rights Committee. He's been approached by military judges upset by this administration's policy on torture. And Scott, before we get to that, can you help us understand the legal end of these memos? Let's start with the Nuremberg defense. The authors say it would be legal for interrogators to say they were just following orders. But wasn't that defense unsuccessful during the Nuremberg trials?
Well, that's correct. Indeed, it wasn't a successful defense, and it's an incorrect statement of United States law right now. And indeed, had these lawyers simply taken the time to examine the Uniform Code of Military Justice and various manuals issued by the uniform military, they would see that an illegal order does not constitute an absolute defense to a criminal charge.
How about the ruling that the president is not subject to U.S. or international laws when waging war?
Well, that issue was decided in the year 1215 at Runnymede when Magna Carta was granted, and it was established that the king was not above the law. Essentially, the argument that's being made here is that the president is, in time of war, above the law, is held accountable to no requirement of an international convention or indeed of domestic U.S. law. And these arguments are, to put it in one word, preposterous.
Well, the administration is and the Pentagon is rushing to say today that these memos didn't have the force of policy. They were merely think pieces.
I don't think that's true. I think we can draw a clear line from these memoranda to what has actually occurred both at Guantanamo and in detention facilities in Iraq and Afghanistan. In fact, I would say the consequences are too clear and too obvious to dismiss these things as think pieces.
Well, in fact, the memos were mostly prepared by the Justice Department and White House Counsel's Office. In fact, the State Department lawyer dissented, didn't want to be involved. He said the positions taken in the memos would weaken the protection of the Geneva Conventions for American troops. What do you think is happening here?
Well, the United States has had a very proud tradition for over 100 years, really, of treating detainees taken on the field of battle in a humane fashion. And since 1949, that has meant observing the Geneva Conventions. And that's something the U.S. military is proud of, and it's something the U.S. military has pursued for the benefit of U.S. soldiers. And now we see all of this being swept aside.
And we understand also that a group of military lawyers actually came to you and asked the Bar Association to prepare a report because they were very upset at what they saw going on.
That is correct. And in fact, after I saw the story in the Washington Post today and the Wall Street Journal story yesterday, I suddenly really put the timeline together. They contacted us at the end of April. We had a meeting at the beginning of May. This memorandum, the Department of Defense memorandum, was concluded in April. I would say it's pretty obvious that they were outraged at that Department of Justice memorandum, and that's what led them to seek out the Bar Association.
Scott Horton, thank you.
Thank you.
Scott Horton, former head of the Human Rights Committee of the New York City Bar Association.
Just ahead, how well does the mantle of former President Ronald Reagan fit President Bush?
And later, can the dust on your personal computer lead to reproductive disorders?
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
As former President Ronald Reagan lies in state in California, we asked people on the streets of Boston to share their thoughts of the Gipper.
Bring communism down and, you know, the economy roared in the 80s. But on the other hand, you know, deficits went up.
I would say his movie with Bonzo the Monkey.
I give him enormous credit for identifying the evil empire rightly, for persuading Gorbachev to bring down the wall, and for forcing the economic issue in such a way with the Soviet Union that it collapsed as a nation.
The image that comes to mind is smiling, jovial, nice guy.
For instilling a form of competence in the American people.
How do you think Reagan's administration compared to our current President Bush's administration?
I think President Bush is a watered-down version without the direction or the charisma.
Well, I think that President Reagan was a much more sympathetic, sincere, open, pleasant fellow than Mr. Bush.
Thoughts on former President Ronald Reagan.
The comparisons do abound. Big tax cuts and bigger federal deficits. Ronald Reagan's railing against the evil empire. George Bush's axis of evil. Some of the many lines being drawn between the two presidents. But at least one former Reagan aide, Doug Bandow, says Bush is trying, but he's no Reagan, in my view. Joining us on the line from Washington is Peter Greer, Washington editor for the Christian Science Monitor, who's also been writing about the world views of these two presidents. Thanks for being with us, Peter.
Thank you.
You've been covering politics for a long time, so you probably know more than most that President Bush has often invoked Ronald Reagan in his decision making. And, of course, many current administration officials have ties to Reagan. What do you see as the most important comparisons between these two men?
Well, I'll say what President Bush would think is the most important comparison, which is he talks often about the moral clarity of the Reagan vision of the world. There is good, there is evil. We are on the side of good. We're going to fight evil. He talks about that in his speeches, and some of his more important foreign policy aides talk about that so-called moral clarity in their speeches as well.
Well, Reagan, of course, was somebody who lectured for years about his political philosophy long before he became president, and his vision thing, so to speak, seemed to be a truly integral part of who he was. Can the same be said about Bush?
Well, you know, the thing about President Bush is Bush has kind of the zeal of a convert, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
The person for whom that philosophy is a part of their very nature, they can be flexible on it sometimes. But the person who's a convert, they're not really sure of their place in the whole religion, so they have to carry out, you know, everything with a little extra added zeal.
Hmm. Although both men did seem to have a real black and white view of the world, they did regard the use of military force somewhat differently. How similar were they on those points, not just in what they thought, but what they did?
Well, the first thing you have to say there is that circumstances are different. We don't know what President Reagan would have done if he were confronted with the events of September 11th.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to remember Reagan came to office at a time when Vietnam still had a lingering effect on the nation's view of itself in the world. You know, it's easy to forget now, but when Reagan invaded the island of Grenada in 1983, that was seen as a big event in terms of American military power re-entering into the world. You know, we were going to throw our weight around, even on very small islands.
But not exactly the same as going into Iraq.
No, not nearly the same as going into Iraq. And, of course, the larger challenge that President Reagan faced in his years was the Soviet Union and the Cold War. And he never, of course, resorted to military force to help him in his problems with that.
I want to ask you about some economic points as well. Paul Krugman writes in the Times today that when President Reagan was confronted with evidence that his tax cuts were fiscally irresponsible, he changed course. President Bush, when confronted with similar evidence, Krugman says, pushed for even more tax cuts. Is there a way to explain that difference in their approach?
Well, I do think Reagan was, as Krugman said, flexible, you know, confronted with evidence that perhaps his policies weren't working either overseas or at home. He did change course. For instance, you remember the U.S. troops sent to Lebanon to help try and calm Lebanon there and the horrible bombing in Beirut that killed so many Marines. And eventually the United States decided it didn't really have a dog in that fight and came home. So that's an example of Reagan being flexible in response to events. It's a little similar to the tax cut example.
And there are also some conflicting views about how much President Reagan actually contributed to the end of the Cold War. Some say a great deal, some say not so much. What did you find on that point?
Well, you know, there are going to be hundreds of PhD theses on in international studies schools all across America on that for years. You know, the process of the dissolution of the Soviet Union was a very long one to which many people contributed on both sides of the Iron Curtain. And President Reagan probably had some role in that. How large a role, we don't really know, because the Soviet Union was obviously economically in trouble even when he came into office. But the one real change that Reagan made in the overall U.S. long-term strategy of containment was he did spend a lot more on the military. And there is evidence that that did indeed kind of daunt the Soviet Union and say, you know, we can't keep up with that.
In terms of personal characteristics, President Reagan, of course, is being remembered as very much the optimist, someone who appealed to people's hopes and not their fears. Can we say the same of Bush?
Well, again, I think circumstances are different. We don't know what kind of public stance Reagan would have given the need to fight terrorism around the world. But obviously, Reagan was a sort of genial, optimistic guy. In his later years, he negotiated eagerly with Mikhail Gorbachev in an effort to eliminate nuclear weapons. They reached some arms agreement, but agreements. But Reagan, for a while, was optimistic that they could reach extremely deep cuts in nuclear weapons that never came about. Right now, President Bush is more of a wartime president, or acts as if he believes he is a wartime president, and that is a much sterner kind of a role. And it's hard to say, one wouldn't call him a sunny person right now in most of his public utterances, for instance.
Mm. Well, one could argue that it's not sunny times either, as you say.
Exactly.
Peter, thank you so much.
Anytime.
Peter Greer is Washington editor for the Christian Science Monitor.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, the White House says news coverage on Al Jazeera is inaccurate. Well, a new documentary, Control Room, takes viewers inside the network.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
There's good news today for some prostate cancer patients. Two clinical trials show that the drug Taxotere can extend the lives of prostate cancer patients after hormonal therapy fails. Another new study, also released today, shows that adding chemotherapy to radiation treatment prolongs survival for people with at least one type of brain cancer. Also in health news, people taking statins such as Lipitor to lower their cholesterol levels may also be inadvertently warding off cancer. It turns out that people who take the drugs for at least 5 years cut their colon cancer risk in half. Statins have previously been shown to cut breast and prostate cancer rates. Well, computer users will also be interested in another study presented in Canada this week. The research reveals that American women have the industrial world's highest levels of the toxic chemical polybromated diphenyl ether, or PBDE, in their breast milk. The chemical comes from flame retardants in computer casings and other household items. A second study about PBDEs shows that the dust on personal computers contains PBDEs and could lead to neurological and reproductive disorders. Robin Schneider is executive director of Public Research Works in Austin, Texas, one of the organizations that commissioned that study. Robin, tell us what you found.
Every computer we tested, no matter how old or young or computer maker, the dust on that computer monitor or flat panel display had these brominated fire retardants in them.
And why do we think that they are a problem?
Well, in studies on lab animals, they have caused brain development problems. They've also affected the thyroid and the reproductive systems of sperm counts of the male rats and also the reproductive system of the female rats.
And we know that the amount of PBDEs in women's breast milk has increased greatly over the last few decades.
The amounts in North American women are doubling every 2 to 5 years. However, in some countries, the levels are leveling off and going down where those governments have taken quick action to phase these chemicals out.
Well, now we hear that some computer companies, including Apple, are taking measures to reduce PBDEs in their products. Is there any government regulation in the U.S.?
Maine was the first state to formally ban DECA-PBDE, which is the one we were looking at in particular, that's used a lot in electronics. Washington will probably be phasing it out as well, but the federal government has not phased out this DECA version. The manufacturers have agreed to phase out two other versions, but they are really pushing hard to keep this DECA version on the market.
How do PBDEs get into our bodies? I mean, we're not eating computer casings.
We are breathing the gas that comes off computers and also breathing in the dust that has the gas attached to it now. So we also are getting in our food. Another study released in Toronto this week showed that high levels of PBDEs in animal-related food products, particularly meat, dairy, unless it's non-fat milk, because this substance accumulates in the fat. That's why it's even been found in the Arctic birds and polar bears, far away from computers. It's kind of building up in the food chain as well as in the dust and the gas in our homes and offices.
Why have there been no studies in humans?
Well, there are literally 80,000 chemicals out there, and while our drugs might be tested for safety, the chemicals put on the market are not. And until we have a better policy that's more preventative and more cautious, we have a whole litany of chemicals out there that we know little to nothing about. But the levels that it cause problems in mice are already found in nature.
Robin Schneider, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Robin Schneider, Executive Director of Public Research Works in Austin, Texas, which has just released a study on the potential health risks of the fire retardant PBDE.
Public hearings began today in Connecticut on whether Governor John Rowland should be impeached. The legislature is investigating charges that Rowland improperly accepted gifts from people doing business with the state. Yesterday, a Superior Court judge ruled that the governor will have to testify in those proceedings, a move that he is continuing to resist. Earlier today, we spoke to John Dankosky, news director for WNPR in Hartford, Connecticut, and asked him to remind us exactly what the governor is accused of.
Well, he's been accused of accepting expensive gifts from state contractors and other friends who have positions within the government. Most of it had centered around the cottage that he has on Bantam Lake in the Litchfield area of Connecticut, but there are many other accusations surrounding real estate deals and other things that have all swirled around. And because the governor hasn't been saying very much recently, a lot of what the people of Connecticut have learned, they've learned from the press.
So essentially, these hearings are designed to connect the dots between the people who did favors for the governor personally and who then got state contracts?
Exactly. The governor has said that he admits to taking some improper gifts. And then he lied about the fact that he took those improper gifts. But the governor has repeatedly said that at no time did he compromise his office.
And what are the chances that, in fact, he will appear before this hearing?
Right now, those chances aren't very good. Yesterday, in Hartford Superior Court, a judge said that the subpoena that the committee that's investigating him, the subpoena that they put forward for him to come testify, can stand. But he also put a stay on this subpoena, saying that Rowland won't have to testify until after an appeal is heard by the state Supreme Court. Now, Rowland's lawyers have used a few delaying tactics so far, and they're expected to be able to delay this in a way that Rowland may never have to testify, even though poll numbers say about 88% of the people of the state really want him to tell his side of the story in front of the committee.
John, how long might these hearings last?
Right now, I think that the hearings are scheduled for a few days this week. They're likely to go into next week, but they've been very cagey as far as how long this whole thing could take. Right now, Gail, they have about 12 people who they've subpoenaed. Many people have said that they won't be appearing to testify. They've taken the Fifth Amendment. These are business associates or personal associates of Rowland's. There are many people who are set to testify who are investigators, people who've come up with all these documents pertaining to personal information or business dealings.
And how likely is it that there will be a vote for impeachment?
Well, right now, this committee is doing fact-finding, and they've been very thorough as far as getting the facts in front of them. And then by the end of the month, June 30th, they have a deadline as to whether or not they're going to put forward some articles of impeachment. If they do, it seems likely that there are the votes in the House of Representatives to be able to move it ahead to a Senate trial. Judging by what the legislators of the state have already said publicly, most of them would already like the governor to leave office. So it seems as though the votes are there if it ever gets to the point of a House vote or a Senate trial.
And is this playing out in any sort of partisan way, or do Republicans as well as Democrats want him to go?
Well, at first, of course, it seemed very partisan, but as time has gone on, a number of prominent Republicans have said it's just time for the governor to either tell the truth fully or to actually leave office. One of the leading Republicans in Congress, Christopher Shays, who's been a friend of Roland in the past, has asked him to leave. He says he's not doing any good for the party or himself or the state.
John, thank you.
Thank you.
John Van Kusky is news director for WNPR, Connecticut Public Radio in Hartford.
Still to come, some of the best books of the summer season, new and recommended, and all-time classics.
You're listening to Here and Now.
There are some who cherish their Texas twang, Midwestern lilt, or Boston Brahmin accent. But in Rhode Island, where the locals continue to pack ya ca side by each to go have coffee milk, some of the Ocean State's residents are hoping to lose the accent by taking a class. Here Now producer Lindsay Crudell visited the Great Rhode Island Accent Reduction Project in Providence, Rhode Island.
Hi, I'm Steve from Rhode Island.
And you're here to take the class today. What brought you here?
I've wanted to purge my Rhode Island accent for 30 years. I saw the article in the paper. I thought I'd take advantage of it.
For 30 years, you've been trying to get rid of your accent. Why?
For 30 years, I've been working in and back and forth in the entertainment business. First as a singer, where the accent doesn't show up as much. But I've made the bridge from music to film. And I know that I sometimes lose jobs because of the accent, the local accent.
Is your mouth a little weak when you open it to speak? Are you smart?
Hi, I'm John DeNugent, and I'm what you call an accent softener.
So what is a Rhode Island accent? Let's get that out of the way first.
First thing about a Rhode Island accent is no ah. We don't pronounce the ah.
Why would you want to lose your Rhode Island accent? As I understand it, Rhode Islanders can be sort of proud of their habits.
It's a feisty accent. It's colorful. It's fun. It's funny. It has a lot of personality. But unfortunately, the accent which has taken over is the California accent, the L.A. accent. The California accent is the accent of broadcasting. It's pronouncing a certain kind of R. So the idea, Riz, you don't add an R when you shouldn't, and you don't drop R's when you should be pronouncing your R's. Another thing is you don't say dog, and you don't say coffee. And New Yorkers even go further, says coffee. So we lost the battle for which accent is standard, and you can't turn back the clock.
Okay, so here's the sound, a nice sound. Aw. Ah.
Ah.
Ah. Which one, no, just intuitively, which one needs to be softened?
Well, it's coffee and you know it's on.
You mentioned the Rhode Island accent alongside the Boston accent and the New York accent. What's the difference between all those accents? They kind of sound the same to me.
What I hear is there's more of the Irish in the Boston accent. There's more of the Italian in the Rhode Island accent. And there's a little bit more of like a 50-50 between Irish and Jewish in the New York accent. Of course, what's underneath it all is the Yankee accent, which is straight from England.
So I understand that you are a native Rhode Islander yourself, and you've returned to the state after 30 years, and you're trying to take the Rhode Island accent away from the Rhode Islanders. Don't you feel like a traitor?
This is a state that's upwardly mobile. And the old blue-collar factory town image, that's passé. What people find is, as they go to community colleges or they go to the state colleges, they start moving up the ladder. Like it or not, you are discriminated against unless you speak standard.
Hi, I'm Rosemary. I'm here to take the class.
What brought you here today?
Discrimination.
Pretend that I'm not holding a microphone in your face and say, park your car in Harvard Yard.
Park your car in Harvard Yard. There you go. That's it.
Why come?
can't the English teach their children how to speak? This verbal class distinction by now should be antique.
Our visit to the Great Rhode Island Accent Reduction Project was produced by Here and Now's Lindsay Kudell.
Stay with us. There's more ahead.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
If you're just joining us, the news from Iraq this hour includes confirmation that four men being held hostage have been freed by coalition forces. The hostages, a Polish citizen and three Italians, appear to be in good health. Meantime, Iraqi resistance forces claim to have kidnapped seven more foreigners, this time from Turkey, because they worked for Americans. Two more car bombings today in the northern Iraqi cities of Baquba and Mosul have killed at least 14 Iraqis and one U.S. soldier. Earlier on our program, we heard from Michael Evans, defense editor of the Times of London, about some of the difficulties of bringing Saddam Hussein to trial.
There are currently 40 people on the famous pack of cards list of 55 who are in detention, and none of them have come forward with any information.
Also, two top officials in Iraq say the interim government has now taken control of the oil industry several weeks ahead of the handover of power later this month.
Summer is here, a time for relaxing at the beach, heading to camp, road tripping, reading. Here now, literary correspondent Steve Almond is in the studio to help us get in the mood with a few of his favorite books for summer. And Steve, I just heard you say, oh, I'm loving reading these words. You're loving these books.
Yeah, there's one new book which I adore, but I am bringing out a couple of old chestnuts out of storage because I read them every summer. I read them every summer. Everybody should have to read these books every summer.
Okay, well, let's start with the new one first.
Absolutely. It's called Awake, and it's by Elizabeth Graver. This is her third novel, actually. Her previous ones, Unraveling and The Honey Thief, were both quite acclaimed, and I think it's a masterpiece. I want to say that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the kind of book, Robin, that if you told me the plot, I would not pick it up and start reading it. It's a woman, Anna Simon, who's sort of 10, 15 years into a marriage. She's got a couple of children. Her youngest son, Max, has a condition that doesn't allow him to go out into the sun. And it's really, to be honest, about the unraveling of her marriage and her identity through an affair. And then she's sort of gradually put back together, but not in a melodramatic way. It's very emotionally haunting and riveting. And I'm just going to give you a little sampling of the prose. It's set primarily at a summer camp, mm-hmm. which is for these kids, called Camp Luna, in which everything happens in the dark because any exposure to the sun will give them bad melanomas. What I remember of that trip, our first trip there, was a sense of moving toward a place I'd been wishing for quietly, almost unconsciously, for the past 9 years, even as I'd thought it didn't exist and never would. What I remember, too, was the feeling of entering a made-up story, for I'd often told Max about a land where night was day and day night, where children ran outside when the sun went down and flowers bloomed white so you could see them in the moonlight. As we drove up the dirt road, a deer stepped out of the woods and Ian, that's her husband, slammed on the brakes. For a long moment then, we all stared, human and animal, the deer so close you could see the flare of its nostrils, the raised tendons in its neck. "Be careful," I said to Ian, after the creature had plunged back into the brush. "Be careful, please." It was something I said too often in those days. "I am," said Ian, "I always am." So you can see, even in that second paragraph, that things are starting to unravel there.
Right, right. And this is a real-life illness that many of us have heard about. And, you know, just for that, just for seeing, how does a family deal with that idea that your child can't see sunlight?
Well, absolutely. But I have to say that it is not one of those books in which the disease dominates the action. It is really about this woman's identity, a very tumultuous and exciting and sexy affair that sort of threatens to rend the family, and how she puts it back together again. It's one of the most, and I'm not married, I'm speaking out of turn, but that's what fiction does. I felt that I was in this woman's life, and I couldn't stop reading the book.
Okay.
It's brilliant.
Awake by Elizabeth Graver, a Massachusetts author. Okay.
Yes. Next. Now this is a little gem I call The Great Gatsby. Just a little something I picked up in a used bookshop. And it is, I think, the single most beautiful novella in American history, certainly.
I'm looking at it in your hands. I've forgotten how small it is.
It is. It is a mere, I mean, it just packs such a wall, 120 pages. Listen to this prose. "There was music from my neighbor's house through the summer nights. In his blue gardens, men and girls came and went like moths among the whisperings and the champagne and the stars. At high tide in the afternoon, I watched his guests diving from the tower of his raft or taking the sun on the hot sand of his beach while his two motorboats slit the waters of the Sound, drawing aquaplanes over cataracts of foam. On weekends, his Rolls-Royce became an omnibus, bearing parties to and from the city between 9 in the morning and long past midnight, while his station wagon scrambled like a brisk yellow bug to meet all trains. And on Mondays, 8 servants, including an extra gardener, toiled all day with mops and scrubbing brushes and hammers and garden shears, repairing the ravages of the night before. This is the preparation for Gatsby's elaborate parties, and it goes on, and the descriptions of the guests and the fruit that's laid out is such an intoxicating portrait of the American lust for wealth and reinvention.
Okay, so if you're not living it, read it.
And it's also, exactly. And it's important to note that this is also set in summer. So these are books that are also set during the summer months. That's our theme for the day. Goodbye Columbus, my father, of course, always refers to it as Goodbye Columbus, by Philip Roth. It is, in fact, another novella, and it's usually packaged with some short stories, and it is Roth before he got too dirty and dark, but it's very, very moving, and I want to read just the first paragraph of Goodbye Columbus.
Okay.
It's a romance set in New Jersey, of course. The first time I saw Brenda, she asked me to hold her glasses. Then she stepped out to the edge of the diving board and looked foggily into the pool. It could have been drained. Myopic Brenda would never have known it. She dove beautifully, and a moment later she was swimming back to the side of the pool, her head of short-clipped auburn hair held up straight ahead of her as though it were a rose on a long stem. I love that. She glided to the edge and then was beside me. "Thank you," she said, her eyes watery, though not from the water. She extended a hand for her glasses, but did not put them on until she turned and headed away. I watched her move off. Her hand suddenly appeared behind her. She caught the bottom of her suit between thumb and index finger and flicked what flesh had been showing back where it belonged. My blood jumped.
I will never adjust my bathing suit in quite the same way again. I forgot about that.
Yeah, I never do. You know, it's such a beautiful opening gesture, you know. And what I think actually all of these share is what great writing shares. They're so concrete. The details are so explicit, you know, the thumb and index finger snapping that flesh back into place, auburn hair like a rose on a stem, you know, the gardeners and everything that they do, you know, and the crates of oranges and lemons in Gatsby.
You can almost hear sort of the buzz of mosquitoes. And
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I was going for the idea of the evocation of summer, hoping, in fact, that when summer does arrive, it's not just mercilessly humid and hot.
That's right. Well, these are not, you know, the typical dog-eared paperback beach books, although they're fine enough, the John Grisham, the Stephen King, the Nora Roberts.
Yes.
But for one last recommendation, there are some of those that you would recommend, the John Irvings, for instance.
Well, sure. I mean, I love A Prayer for Owen Meany. I love The World According to Garp. Let me say in defense of Gatsby and Columbus, as if they need defending from me, they are riveting. And this applies to Awake as well. I chose, you know, the guilt-free beach reading concept. I chose what I think are great beach reads that are at the same time exciting and stimulating. Because I think of beach reading, sometimes you try to choose stuff that's plot-driven because you don't want to really work too hard at the reading. We're not looking at Henry James here. You know, this isn't the Bostonians, 1,000 pages and every sentence is 4 pages long. These are very, very smartly written and easy. You just dive right into them.
Plus, in the case of The Great Gatsby, there's a certain retro thing you'll notice going on the beaches anyway, with skirts over bathing suits, these little fashion things.
I'm certainly wearing skirts over my bathing suits.
So you'll be right in the mood. Steve, thank you.
Thank you.
Here and now, literary correspondent Steve Almond, also the author of the new book, Candy Freak.
I'll take summer, that's my time of year. Winter's shadow seems to disappear. Gayest one is season, that's the reason I can say that I love a summer day.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
As always, we welcome your thoughts on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397.
Please, please, please tell us how to pronounce your full name and tell us the town you're from. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
To me, it's like a summer day.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.